Well, we welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals this morning. We only have the one case on our docket, Miller versus Great Lakes, cause number 21687CV. I'd like to introduce our visiting justice, Charles Blyle, if you all haven't argued in front of him before. And then Justice Walker, Sue Walker is to my right, and I'm Chief Justice Livingston. So it's good to have you all here with us today. And Mr. Lee, if you're ready to get going.
May it please the court. Again, my name is Robert Lee. I represent Stephanie Miller in this particular matter. This case is essentially a fairly simple case, although there's been a lot of paper that's been generated as a result. In essence, my client was propositioned for sex at the beginning of her employment. She refused that sex. By the next week when the new schedule came out, they started cutting her hours. And within 2 weeks of being employed, the manager that she reported to essentially had her terminated. There has been a lot of confusion about the issues related to sexual harassment, discrimination, quid pro quo, and all those other things, and all the legal briefing related to this particular matter. And I'd like to kind of just address that from the beginning because of the concerns related to that. Over the years, there, as sexual harassment kind of came up and they were trying to determine what was actual, what wasn't, and quid pro quo came out of that, those case laws related to that, essentially propositioning someone for sex and then retaliation thereafter for failure to do so. The law has gone all over the place on whether or not an employer can be held liable for that. The law was kind of all over the place related to whether it was a supervisor involved, what responsibility they may have, because it used to be a standard of knew or should have known. And if you had to demonstrate that the employer, whoever the employer was, knew or should have known that the actions were occurring and had to make, and determinations were made somewhat related to that. The Supreme Court in 99 came down with two cases, the United States Supreme Court. And of course, the law is clear that under Texas law, they follow the guidance of the United States Supreme Court unless there's some reason to believe otherwise, especially since the laws have changed. Texas courts have done nothing but follow federal law since the beginning of the statute being put in place, Texas Human Rights Act. But essentially, in 1998-1999, the court got through all these determinations and trying to make a determination as to when is employer liable for certain actions that occur in the workplace. And it went through a number of aspects of agency principles, and I'm sure the court is aware of the main cases, just to make sure we're on the same page, are the Burlington Industries versus Ellis case, which is 524 U.S. 742, and the Farragher versus Boca Raton case, 524 U.S. 775. Both of those cases came out together. And in essence, they go through the agency principles on when they're responsible, and they came up with the determination of when they're looking at discrimination and harassment, when can the employer or company be held liable? And they essentially found that a company is held liable when a supervisor essentially is making a determination or a person is making a determination that can affect the terms and conditions of employment. So if you have a situation where it did not affect the terms or condition of employment, then you go into the terms and condition of employment has been defined in many cases, you know, firing obviously and promotion, things of that sort. In our case, we also believe any type of change in pay or anything of that respect. If you do not have one of those terms or conditions of employment, then it falls within the hostile work environment standard, and you have to make a determination on whether it's severe or pervasive or not. And the law is different related to whether or not it's a supervisor that's doing the harassment or whether it's an employee doing the harassment. Because if it's a supervisor determining whether it's harassment, then it's determined that they can be held liable, but they give an affirmative defense to the employer saying, look, we have a policy in place to prevent this from happening and should have reported it, and so be it. But if you have a situation where essentially they actually, supervisor actually affected a term and condition of employment, they are strictly liable. The Vance versus Ball case, which everyone on both sides have mentioned in this case, this is a matter that was, Vance versus Ball is 133 Supreme Court 2434, was determined in 2013. It says if supervisor harassment of employee culminates in a tangible employment action, the employer is strictly liable. Tangible employment action in this case, a tangible employment action defined in this particular document, essentially talks about benefits, significant change in employment status, such as hiring, firing, failing to promote, reassignment with significantly different responsibilities, or decision causing a significant change in benefits. And in this case, we're only complaining about two different events. The two different events we're complaining about is A, they cut her hours after she complained, and B, they terminated her after she complained. All the rest doesn't matter. These are absolutely determinations that are clearly tangible employment actions for this case. We have case law that we provided to the court in our brief that talks about changing, cutting hours absolutely does, is a tangible employment action because it affects their pay. If you affect somebody's pay, there's a tangible employment action. Now, there have been cases that have been cited by the defendant in this case saying, well, if you move somebody's hours, you move them from one shift to another, that's probably not a tangible employment action. But that's not the case here. We presented evidence in this particular case, not only the deposition of our client, which stated that her hours were cut, but we also provided evidence of her hours cut during those 2 weeks. We have in our summary judgment response, we provided the specific documentation. Well, in her deposition, she talked about it, as well as the documentation was submitted shows that the first week that she worked, if Exhibit 9 to the deposition of Mr. McGuire, it shows that she was worked 3 days for hours of around 26 hours. The next week, when she was given when they changed the schedule, her hours were cut that very next week, and it was cut to only working 2 days at 7 hours, and then the next week it was cut to only 3 hours that following week. And then a circumstance occurred at the store where there essentially was a claim that someone had not done proper cash in, cash out procedures at the store. They claimed that the computer records showed that whoever was involved in that cash in, cash out procedure did not do the proper log in and log outs as required, and that was an important thing to them. This manager who committed this sexual harassment specifically told them, oh, it was her. She says, I was never even on the register. I was never assigned to that register under those circumstances or that time period, and provided an affidavit that states that, completely proves that what he says is completely untrue. That we're able to prove not only the timing but also pretext related to these matters. But the arguments that have been made by opposing counsel have not focused about those issues. They have said that somehow this should fall into the hostile work environment realm and not in the realm of strict liability. And they essentially say because it was only one comment, and they can't be held liable. And they're also saying that he's not a supervisor, so as a supervisor, he can't held liable. Well, there's really no doubt that he was in charge of putting together the schedule and determining how many hours my client worked. Made complete determination how many hours my client worked. He was the only store manager at this particular Subway. There was an area manager that kind of went from had five or six stores that was over him, but he made the complete determination on schedule. There's also not any not any dispute, that he told them when this audit occurred that she was the one that was responsible and that he actually did the termination of her. He was absolutely involved in this determination. Now, if one wants to argue that somehow, well, he's not a supervisor, and we say argue, which I found to be interesting because he's the head guy at the store and he's the one that was involved in the hiring. He made all the recommendations. He brought him in, made the recommendation of hiring, and they said that anytime he usually recommends someone, they usually hire them, and that's what they did. And he's involved in the day-to-day instruction as well as her hours. To sit there and say that that's not a supervisor is kind of, it doesn't make any sense, but it really doesn't matter in this case because he had actual authority to make the determination that he made related to her hours, and he's the one that told management essentially that she committed the act that justified the termination. Now, he was not the supervisor that ultimately made the termination decision, but we provided case law that talks about the issue of cat's paw, which essentially says the manager essentially is one that's worked, is in that chain of command, essentially is giving information that to the others that essentially is forming the basis for termination. In this case, he gave the information, claimed my client did something that she didn't do to get her terminated. Then they're held liable for that under the cat's paw theory. A company cannot be insulated from liabilities because they have somebody at the top that always makes the decisions that gets information from other people. If that was the case, a company would do was have somebody up top, all right, tell me why you want to have them fired. I want to fire them because they're late every day. And their real motivation might be because their race or because they didn't engage in sexual relations with them. That manager wouldn't know one way or another and says, okay, well, you can fire them. The company would never be held liable if they made a if the cat's paw theory didn't apply, and it applies in this particular case the same way.
Is there actually some summary judgment evidence showing that he made a report regarding this cash register to the area supervisor or someone above him?
Yeah, it's undisputed.
Okay.
It's undisputed that the testimony of Mr. Donato.
Okay.
Make sure I get that wrong. The deposition testimony of the security investigator said when he went in, he specifically asked him who did it, and he pointed it at my client, and that's the reason why she got fired. And again, we have specific evidence showing contradicting that particular aspect. My client says that is not true. I never did any of that. So,
what does it mean?
Say it again.
Who did what?
Meaning on the act?
Did it.
Say it again.
She did it, and I just want to know what it is.
Oh, okay. Mr. Donato claims that he went in and did an investigation on and looks at the computer sheets to see who's working cash register supposedly. And that, or at least it's supposed to show, whenever there's a change in shift, you have to put in your number as to who's working the cash register, who's not working the cash register. And he said he went in there and showed that the person had worked the cash register that day had not put in the information they were supposed to put in to show they were working the cash register. And he asked the store manager, Mr. McGuire, who was the person on the cash register that day. And he said it was Ms. Miller, said it was my client. My client said, that's not true. I never worked that cash register at any time that day. And then we provided an affidavit confirming that particular point. Did that answer your question on that?
Not really. And you've given a very good legal history of this kind of questions, but I'm not sure what she did still. I know you explained it. I just heard you.
Yeah, let me try again. It is a little confusing. I don't doubt. I mean, I spent a lot of hours asking questions about trying to figure this out, right? The computer is an electronic computer, and when an employee gets on to that cash register, it's on the cash register. And they get on the cash register, they're supposed to plug in their code as to they're on the cash register now, so they can keep track of who was actually working on the cash register at a given time. And you can go back and pull that code stuff up, and you can see who logged in, who logged out related to that particular matter. And it was determined that whoever worked that cash register that day did not log in or log out that day. And Mr. McGuire essentially lied and said it was my client that did it in order to get her fired, or failed to do it in order to get her fired. That was the circumstance related to that particular issue. The problem we also have is that that login and logout sheets, all that stuff, supposedly they just lost them. We asked for it 6 months after. Is it time to go? Six months afterwards, it comes up missing, and they knew they terminated her. So we had a spoliation claim to show that evidence would have also been helpful to us as well. I'm going to sit down.
I think Judge Blyle has another question.
Yes.
Well, she was propositioned for sex.
Yes, sir.
She declined.
Yes.
She was fired. Is that correct? She was fired.
She was fired 2 weeks later. They cut her hours the first week, cut her hours the second week, and then he got her fired by saying that she basically did something she didn't do.
What does the cut her hours have to do with anything?
Because it falls right within a tangible employment action. It's part of the case. I mean, she lost money as a result of refusing his sexual advances. And so cutting her hours means she made less money for those next 2 weeks. Was told that if she was going to work like everyone else in the 20-hour range, instead they cut her hours back down to basically 10 and 3. And then they fired her for this alleged event.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Ms. Stoddard.
May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Stoddard, and I'm here today on behalf of the Appalachee Great Lakes. Let me briefly talk about the facts. I'm sure you're familiar with them, but there's a few things that I think have been left out that are critical. Ms. Miller was a part-time employee. She testified in her deposition that she expected as a part-time employee to work about 15 hours a week. And during the 2 weeks of her employment, she averaged a little over 15 hours a week. She only worked on 7 days during that two-week period. And Ms. Miller testified in her deposition that she barely worked with Mr. McGuire, who is the alleged perpetrator. In fact, she stated, "He was barely ever there with me." And that's in the record on page 237. She alleges that he made this comment on the very first day of her employment within the first couple of hours of her being there. I think it's critical to note that the comment is not a threat. It sounds a little bit more like a joke. Assuming that it happened, it sounds a little bit more like a joke. She testified that she asked him to come over to the sandwich station so she could ask him a question. And he walked over and he said, "What, do you want to have sex for a promotion?" Now, Ms. Miller testified that she did not find that comment serious at the time. When asked if she thought that Mr. McGuire was capable of giving her a raise on the first day of her employment, she replied, "No, of course not." It's also important to note that she did not apply for a promotion and she was never denied a promotion. Another important fact is on this very morning that this happened, Ms. McGuire's area supervisor was in the Subway store. Ms. McGuire testified through admissions and at her deposition that she knew who her area supervisor was and knew that she had agreed to a sexual harassment policy, a written policy, stating that she should report any type of harassment, either to herself or anyone else, to that supervisor. So on the very morning that this alleged comment occurred, Ms. Miller's supervisor was in the Subway Cafe, and she did not report it to her then. She did not report it to her ever, and she never reported it to anybody in management. Regarding the separation, with all due respect to Mr. Lee, I believe that the vast majority of what he told you is not in the summary judgment record. Basically, Mr. Donato is an independent auditor hired by Great Lakes. He does audits at random in various stores to see if employees are complying with POS policy. He discovered on the morning that he did this one audit that an employee had not complied. Mr. McGuire simply gave him the names of the people who were logged onto the computer at that time. There's no connection between, excuse me, let me back up. Mr. Donato then reports that to the Vice President of Operations, who's Rodney Mahaffey. Mr. McGuire never spoke to Mr. Mahaffey. Mr. Mahaffey unequivocally made the decision to terminate Ms. Miller because she violated the POS system. And that is a policy of Great Lakes, and it's a policy which Ms. Miller signed off on and acknowledged in her deposition that she knew about. There was never communication between Mr. McGuire and Mr. Mahaffey. When Mr. Mahaffey made the decision to terminate Ms. Miller, he had no idea that she had an allegation of sexual harassment. She had not informed anybody at the company about it, and in fact, she filed a unemployment claim a few weeks after her termination, and she never mentioned the harassment in that claim either. And the employment claim, the entire file is in the record, as well as Ms. Miller's testimony, where she testified that she did not include it in her workers' comp claim. The first time that Great Lakes found out that there was an allegation of harassment was when they got the EEOC claim from the EEOC, and that was several weeks, if not months, later. I do want to point...
So let me clarify one thing. So the sexual harassment claim was identified in her EEOC claim, but not her Texas workers' comp claim. Is that correct?
That's correct, Judge. And both those files are in the court record.
Okay.
So you can find those. Moving on, I do want to point out the issue of waiver. At the summary judgment level, the appellee, we lodged several objections to the appellant's recitation of evidence and facts because it was largely not supported by the evidence. There were so many objections, in fact, that we filed a separate motion for summary judgment objections. You can find that in the court's record at page 494. The objections were things such as hearsay, conclusory statements, subjective beliefs. There were citations by the appellant that didn't at all coincide with the factual recitation. There was even a summary chart of created by appellant's attorney in a request for disclosure that was not supported by any evidence that we objected to. The trial court sustained all of those objections in a separate order, and it made a specific order on every objection, and that's at the clerk's record at page 535. The appellant, in its motion for reconsideration / motion for new trial, did not specifically address those objections. In fact, at the page 542 in the record, the only thing that the appellant said about the objections is that the court should reconsider the objections as well. I'm sure this court understands that that does not comply with Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 33.1A. Specifically, 33.1A requires that an objection to a trial court's ruling must state the grounds specifically and succinctly so that the trial court has the opportunity to look at
you
that.
You were the one objecting. You are the one objecting to the summary judgment evidence, and the trial court ruled on it. So what did the appellant have to object to?
They have to object to the trial court's rulings, or they waive them.
That's your position?
Yeah, if they do not object to the trial court's rulings in the motion for new trial,
I thought we were past the era of exceptions where you have to say, I accept your ruling. I mean, once the trial court's ruled, what is there to object to?
Well, in a recent case in El Paso, the El Paso court ruled that to preserve error on a ruling excluding summary judgment evidence, an appellant must inform the trial court of the purpose for which the evidence was offered and the reason why it was admissible. That's Community Initiatives, Inc. versus Chase Bank. It's found at 153 Southwest 3rd. Page 270, El Paso. There's a Dallas case as well Brooks versus Sherry Lane National Bank at 788 Southwest 2nd, 874. Recently, in 2006, the Dallas court found that when an appellee urges several objections to evidence and the appellant complains of its exclusion, which they are here, it must challenge every objection raised or it waives them on appeal. That's Cantu versus Haroni at 195 Southwest 3rd.
In their appellate brief, and they have challenged in their appellate brief the rulings. They've raised those rulings. They've raised the trial court's rulings as issues in their brief.
I agree
they have to raise it in their brief, but I don't think they have to put it in a motion for a new trial or somehow object in the trial court.
I think they have to give the trial court the opportunity to review its ruling to determine whether or not it was correct. And I believe that's what those cases state.
Is there a rule, a civil rule that requires that?
I believe there are a couple of rules that require that, Judge. Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 321 and 322 generally talk about an objection to a trial court's ruling must be specific enough so that the court can ascertain what it is they're objecting to about the ruling and why they believe the ruling is inadequate.
So you have to do all that in the trial, or you can't raise that point on appeal?
I think you have to raise it at the trial court level, yes. Now, if they had not filed a motion for new trial or a motion for reconsideration, then probably not. But in the alternative, the standard, as I'm sure you know, is an abuse of discretion standard. And summary judgment evidence is well within the trial court's discretion. In order for this court to find that the trial court abused its discretion in granting the objections, it would have to find that it made the decision arbitrary in an arbitrary and capricious manner. In fact, the Rhodes versus Murphy case, which is out of this court, so I'm sure you all know it well, states that an appellate court must uphold the trial court's rulings if there is any legitimate reason for it. And that's Rhodes versus Murphy, 188 Southwest 3rd at 252. If I can turn briefly to the supervisor issue, the definition of a supervisor has been pretty established now since the Vance decision that Mr. Lee spoke about. The Vance decision basically states that an employee is only a supervisor if the employer itself empowers the employee to take a tangible employment decision. The employee must be acting within the scope and authority of the company, and the employer must specifically empower the employee to hire, fire, promote, demote, that type of thing. Things such as managing daily activities, which perhaps Mr. McGuire did, and routine work decisions have been specifically held not to be the types of activities that basically qualify someone as a supervisor. Vance spoke directly about these types of activities, and in addition, there's a case that we cited in our brief, Arango versus Telemundo. It's a Western District of Texas case, 2013. In that case, there was an employee who was assigned to do things such as create work schedules, counsel employees on what to do when they made errors, to post discrepancies on a tote board in hours and things of this nature. And the court specifically held, and this is an important case because this is basically what the appellant states that Mr. McGuire was empowered to do, and the court unequivocally states that based on the language in Vance, which is the U.S. Supreme Court case, that there is not supervisory authority unless you can make a significant employment decision such as hiring and firing. Now, Mr. McGuire testified in his deposition that he was not empowered to hire or fire. Mr. Mahaffey, who is the vice president of operations who did the hiring and terminating, testified that he was the only one who could do that. And with regard to the hours, let me just address that. I believe that one other thing Mr. Lee said is that where Mr. McGuire could make recommendations, to his employer. That also has been held not to qualify somebody as a supervisor. There's a Fifth Circuit case from 2014, Spencer versus Schmidt Electric at 576 Fed Appendix 442. And it basically said that if you have to seek permission up the chain of command, then you're not a supervisor. Regarding the hours, there's evidence in the record regarding the hours, and I invite the court to look at those. You know, I don't believe that her hours were cut. She worked 3.5 hours the first day she was there when the alleged incident happened. The following day, she worked 7.68 hours. The next day, 7.61 hours. She was off for a couple of days. Then she worked 8 hours the following day. She worked for 2 weeks part-time. She worked 7 days out of those 2 weeks. She testified that she anticipated when she took the job earning about working about 15 hours a week, and she averaged 15.82 hours in the 2 weeks that she worked. Regardless, cutting someone's hours has been held by the courts of this state not to be an administrative activity that does not qualify someone to be a supervisor. There's a case out of Dallas, Northern District of Texas, Wayne versus Dallas Morning News, 78 Fed Sup at 78, and it basically says that cutting a person's hours is an administrative task. It is not a supervisory task. It relies on the Benningfield case, the Fifth Circuit Benningfield case. There was one case cited by the appellant in her brief that she said supports that cutting hours would be a supervisory activity. It's an 11th Circuit case, so I don't think it applies. But it's the Cotton versus Cracker Barrel case. But what it actually says is that cutting hours, along with evidence that employees' regular hourly rate has been reduced as a result, could lead to one to believe that that's a supervisory authority. The problem is that in this case, there is no evidence whatsoever of the appellant not having a reduction in her weekly wages or her daily wages. There's no evidence one way or the other. There's no evidence of what her regular wages were. Frankly, I don't know that she worked long enough to probably establish that, but there's no evidence of what her hourly rate was. There's no evidence of what she made in a week. There's simply no evidence. I see my time's up. Anything further?
Thank you. Mr. Lee, rebuttal?
First of all, on the issue of objections, I'm not clear at all what the issue of objections as she raised them. My understanding of the law related to objections is that the person who raises the objection must get a ruling on those in order to be able to address them on appeal. But there's not any those rules do not say what she stated related to somehow that we have to have filed a motion for a new trial and have to get the objections dealt with. These objections were made just a day or two right before the time of the hearing, and as well as we have motion for trial, we have more, that the law says that you have less time to deal with those particular matters, so that's not something they require you to do. As it relates to the evidence, and the objections themselves, I'm not even sure how they're relevant, because most of the evidence that we have related to is clear. She said that they didn't have evidence related to relying on Mr. Miller. The testimony in our brief, we mentioned, and in the summary judgment motion, mentioned on Donato depositions, pages, actually it's in the record 345, 348 through 349, there are specific discussions where he relied on Mr. McGuire as to tell him that essentially it was our client that made that act that caused that problem. I'm just going to go through a few things. You mentioned TWC, which you know that there's the Texas Workforce Commission does unemployment and civil rights stuff. So she did mention it related to civil rights stuff. When she asked for employment, she just mentioned I got fired. So she did, and that's a cross-examination point, but that's not an issue for appeal or in summary judgment that somehow destroys the case in any way, shape, or form.
Do you believe that the plaintiff created sufficient fact issues regarding the reduction in hours, or do you think that the facts on the reduction of hours were clearly established by either side?
Well, they did some kind of manipulating to try to show that she didn't lose hours, but if you look at pages 330, the record 330, 335, you'll see the weekly payroll sheets, and it'll show the first week, it had 26 hours, second week, right around 12 or 13 hours, and next week, 3 hours. So you'll be able to see that, and that was part of the summary judgment record, that was part of what we talked about, and our client also testified that her hours are cut. So is it a fact issue? I don't know how it's a fact issue on their side, but it clearly demonstrates to us that that her hours were reduced. I guess they could try to tell the jury otherwise. The issue with the hostile worker, whether a supervisor or not, to sit there and say somebody that is the only person at the store who makes a determination on how many hours you work every single day, what you do every single day, and can recommend your termination is not a supervisor, it's just a bastardization of how the law applies. All these cases she talks about are only supervisors where the supervisor was kind of like a lead man, and he just kind of was in there, and he kind of helped them, told them occasionally what they're to do, and they had no ability to make any determination whatsoever related to their terms, conditions, employment. That is not the case here. And even if it was, given the fact that he did do it and had the authority to do it, they're liable under strict liability related to those particular matters.
Do you agree that you didn't challenge the summary judgment on the hostile work environment on appeal? You only challenged the quid pro quo sexual harassment claim on appeal?
I think that we, out of abundance of caution, went ahead and mentioned on the appeal that even if you're claiming it is hostile work environment, we went through the elements in our appellate brief related to, they can't justify it under that circumstance. But is it, if we're talking about the one comment, and is the one comment in and of itself hostile work environment, if that's all the court were to rely on, then I guess that's possible that would not meet the hostile work environment standard by itself. But our case isn't about the comment as much as the comment is what precipitated the things that happened thereafter. It's the cutting of the hours and it's the termination. That's what our case is about. If all he had made it a comment and nothing happened to her otherwise, this case wouldn't have been brought. We wouldn't have brought any type of case. This is based on quid pro quo retaliation type situation that happened to her as a result of her denying wanting to have sex. Under their determination, they're basically saying, if you take the law as they say it, you as a anyone walks into a workplace and their boss comes up to them and says, I want to have sex with you, and you say, heck no. And let's say it's not a boss that only has a little bit of authority, and then somehow they are able to get you fired, that's not actionable in any way, shape, or form. That cannot be what the law is. It cannot be that this woman objected to the sexual advances, specifically told them, all of a sudden her hours are cut and she gets fired by this person. Let's assume some of the facts are absolutely as I say they are, and there's clear evidence that, yes, I'm cutting your hours now because you just did that, or I'm getting you fired because you did that. To say that that's not actionable would be completely wrong, and it would be contrary to all the law related to protecting women in the workplace. Is there anything else that I can answer? Thank you, guys.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lee. Ms. Stoddard, we appreciate all of your briefing in this matter, as well as your oral arguments here today. So your case is now submitted, and you all are excused, and we'll adjourn court.
All right. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.